My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is Dr. Willie J. Parker, a reproductive justice advocate who is Associate Medical Director of Family Planning Associates in Chicago. Dr. Parker formerly served as Medical Director of Planned Parenthood of Metropolitan Washington, D.C., and was Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology in the John Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii. Dr. Parker graduated from Berea College in Kentucky, and he holds an MD degree from the University of Iowa, as well as a master's degree from the Harvard School of Public Health and a master's of science in health services research from the University of Michigan. His work focuses on violence against women, women's reproductive health and rights, and men's reproductive health. So welcome, Dr. Parker. That's an impressive list of accomplishments and degrees.
Well, thanks, Sally.
And we're talking to you today, I think, with many different hats. So as a doctor, as an abortion provider, and we're also talking to you as a person of faith. So I'd like to start off with talking about one of the new anti-abortion bills that's on the horizon. And it's called the 20-week ban, because it would ban abortions at 20 weeks. We know that 13 states have already passed these bans, and last month the House of Representatives passed its own 20-week ban. Beyond that, there are some Republicans in the Senate who want to introduce a 20-week ban as well. And what supporters say is the reason they're doing this is it's a very reasonable bill. In fact, it's a compassionate bill because fetuses can feel pain at 20 weeks, and that's why this is an important bill. And it sounds like they may have some support, at least in terms of polling, in public opinion as well. So let's start off with that issue of pain, which is a very visceral one, but the science behind it and the emotions. So you're a medical doctor, you're an abortion provider, you're a person of faith. What do you say to that claim of theirs?
Well, Sally, I start with what the late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan said, in that he said everyone's entitled to their own opinion and no one's entitled to their own facts. And medicine is based on scientific evidence. And it is clear that when we make decisions about health care and medicine, it should be based on science. So religion is protected by our right to have our religious beliefs, but we're not entitled to our own opinions when it comes to health care. And clearly, the scientific evidence shows that there's no scientific support for the notion that a fetus at 20 weeks can feel pain. In fact, the very structures necessary to carry the stimulus that could be interpreted as pain aren't even developed until at the end of the 29th week. So the notion that a fetus can feel pain is not even a viable one until about the 30th week or into the third trimester. 20 weeks is, as a result of that, becomes a very arbitrary number. I think it adds to this notion of a pregnancy lasts 40 weeks, so at 20 weeks you're halfway through the pregnancy, and so that, as the logic would go, most women should know and should have made up their minds by then. And in actuality, 88% of women who end their pregnancies do so in the first 12 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So the reality is that most women do, when they realize that they're pregnant and that they don't want to become a parent or they're not going to continue it, they do that. But 20 weeks becomes arbitrary because it seems reasonable because it says it's halfway through. But there's also a lot of critical development that still has to happen before a fetus could ever carry, feel pain. And so, again, that happens at 30 weeks. So I try to deal with the facts and respect the fact that people have their opinions. But when it comes to medicine, being a scientist, I stick to the facts. I respect the fact that people want to be compassionate and want to make sure that when we end the pregnancy that fetus is not suffering, but there's no scientific evidence to suggest that, and so there's no reason to pursue that. It really becomes a very indirect way of conferring personhood on the fetus, and allows for people to be moved in a certain way. And so I just have to stick to the fact that as a scientist, I know that there is no credence to the idea that a fetus can feel pain. Although as a physician, I'm very compassionate and would do anything necessary to present to alleviate pain and suffering. That's what I do as a physician. But there's no reason to do that in an abortion.
So what you're saying is it's not like you're this cruel person. You're just telling the truth in terms of the facts and saying that it's really important for medicine to be based on the facts and not somebody's idea of something. And I imagine we can go back in medical history and see times when things were, you know, based on facts, like notions about women, like if women exercise too much, they wouldn't be good mothers, or they shouldn't work out of the home because their brains were smaller. And none of that was factual. You know, it was just like people's ideas. And I think you're right. It does make sense to what does the science say? What is it that we know? You were talking about the 20th week here, and that's another thing that supporters of the ban talk about. They say at a 20th week, a woman is halfway through or a little bit more than halfway through her pregnancy. That's plenty of time to have decided if she's going to have an abortion or not. And, you know, if she waits until that long, well, then that's just too bad. She should have decided earlier. How do you respond to that, especially when you were talking earlier about some developmental things that maybe show up later? What's involved with keeping that option open?
Well, as I said, the majority of women, well, I've not met many women. The majority, overwhelming majority of women are very thoughtful about their decision to end the pregnancy. And the ones who aren't thoughtful, they do a good job of convincing me of that fact. And so, given that women are very thoughtful, and given that we now have the ability to diagnose pregnancy earlier with new tests and that kind of thing, more sensitive pregnancy tests, and women being suspicious when their menstrual cycles change, again, 88% of women end a pregnancy if they're going to do so in the first 12 weeks. But the remaining women who will have to make the decision to whether or not to continue a pregnancy. The overwhelming majority of those later pregnancies are by women who either had no idea that they were pregnant until they found out, or they have health issues that worsened after they had established that they were going to continue the pregnancy, or they have the devastating news of a very much desired pregnancy being found with a later diagnosis, whether it be something structural or chemical. You know, we have different types of fetal diagnostic testing. Some of those severe abnormalities or lethal anomalies, as we call them, aren't detected until much later. And so to have an absolute blanket statement that simply based on the amount of time that's elapsed in a pregnancy, there's an absolute about if a woman hasn't made up her mind by then she loses her right to make that very important decision, is just very arbitrary, and it's in defiance of the fact that there are many diagnoses that aren't established until much later. The development of a pregnancy is a very dynamic process from start to finish, and in fact, some of the more critical development around viability happens in those last 4 weeks. You know, the pregnancy is growing all the time, but some of the structures, like, for example, the ability of the lungs to exchange air and CO2, but most fetal lungs can't expand unassisted until after 25 weeks. So that it at 20 weeks, there's not a pregnancy that is, if it were delivered either spontaneously or if it was induced, that would survive outside the womb.
Mm-hmm.
So again, to arbitrarily pick 20 weeks simply because it represents in the mind of, in a non-scientific way, some people that half the pregnancy is over, is in defiance of the facts, one, of what further development needs to occur to make a pregnancy, a fetus viable, as well as what the often difficult circumstances are that arise with a woman coming to the knowledge later in her pregnancy that she can no longer continue.
So if you had to, if you could pull back the curtain and say, okay, this is this 20-week ban, it's cloaked in, you know, fetal pain and compassion for, you know, the woman and all of that, but there's something else that's really behind it. What's really behind the, what's the intent and what's the strategy behind the 20-week ban?
It is it's a shift of, it is the recognition that the overwhelming majority of people, even if you say only about 60%, even if that number has declined to close to half, still represents the majority of people understand that in some form or fashion, women need to have the right to make, to have an abortion, either for health reasons or other circumstances. And so given that there's no likelihood of absolutely banning abortion outright, I think that these strategies represent a more subtle way of, you know, of trying to parse away at reproductive rights by appealing to what would appear to be logical and reasonable and emotional aspects of reproductive health. You know, the focus is now on, you know, we've taken the focus off of women, because when you focus on the health of women, abortion, the case is made for abortion.
Right.
But if you personify the fetus or a pre-viable pregnancy and turn it into a person or a baby and then imply that there's suffering going on and then imply that all of the majority of women who have an abortion, they're doing so out of, with a callous disregard for the life development that's occurring inside of them, it makes it easier to have people to be unsympathetic or indifferent to the real value of abortion. That is the life-saving measure it is for women. And the fact that the reality is that women are empowered both morally but and intellectually, but as well as legally, to make the decision about whether or not to continue a pregnancy and become a parent.
What you just said makes me think of what they're really doing is they're pitting women against the fetus, making them like adversaries, and then the woman becomes the fetus, and then the little, I mean, the woman becomes the villain, and then the fetus is the is who you have to protect and save.
You're absolutely right. And in obstetrics, we call that area where these dilemmas come up maternal-fetal conflict.
Yeah.
For example, women who have severe health issues and yet they have an otherwise viable pregnancy that is too early in the development to survive outside the womb. And so then you're forced to choose between the woman and the pregnancy that she's carrying. We call that maternal-fetal conflict. But here, these are false conflicts that are being created, and without the ability to look at these issues in a more complex way, people very simplistically say, oh, well, you know, especially when they blend religion into it, say, okay,
yeah,
God's in control, it's God's will. If God wills that this, both the mother and the fetus and the baby survive, it'll be so.
Yeah.
And so I think you're entitled to that opinion, but we cannot make health policy based on those kinds of thoughts.
Right. So you talked about a number of restrictions. You just mentioned them, and the 20-week ban is one of them. But there are lots of others, too, that require, you know, providers to have certain privileges in hospitals and clinics to, you know, have the halls have to be a certain width, or they need janitor closets, or all of those kinds of things. What's the impact of these restrictions, and does it differ for women, you know, like where you live or how economically privileged you are?
The impact of these restrictions are huge because it is, in my opinion, an abuse of regulatory authority, again, in lieu of being able to overturn Roe v. Wade, which really prioritizes the health of women and makes it a privacy issue. Or to arouse the sympathy for a pre-viable fetus by conferring personhood on it. These laws represent a different strategy of hyper-regulation and making, you know, under the premise of making abortion safe, that we're going to make it so safe. I guess the safest abortion is one that never occurs. That
would
be in the mind of some of the antis.
Right.
But it's to make it so so cumbersome to pursue it, whether it be from the doctor's standpoint or the patient's standpoint, as to make it impractical even when it remains legal. And I think part of this has been driven by this perceived window of opportunity with what happened with the Kermit Gosnell case.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to say that, you know, for people to refer to what Dr. in the context of abortion. It would be like referring to Frankenstein in the context of transplant medicine.
Yeah, you know, it has, that's a good, yeah.
They have nothing to do with one another.
Right,
and
right.
Dr. Gosnell was committing criminal action and in a way that outrages any compassionate and logical person, if abortion providers included. But these laws represent, a strategic way of undermining the legal access under the pretense that they are improving the safety. But that's like, these are solutions in search of a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
There is no problem with abortion. There is no question that abortion is life-saving. There is no question that it is health care. But they've decided to turn it into a problem so that they can fix it. And they're trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist.
But when you talk about hyperregulation and abuse of regulatory authority, it's really ironic because this is coming from conservatives and sometimes libertarians who are always screaming about overregulation, and they're the worst offenders in this case.
You're absolutely right. It's it's almost. Really paradoxical.
It's
right?
Very paradoxical. Yeah, it really is. The two just don't line up at all. Let's talk about your faith here for a minute. And I have heard you be actually pretty eloquent in talking about why you do the work that you do, why you provide abortion care for women, and it's because of your faith. And those two things are not usually in the same sentence with an and. It's usually with a but. And can you connect those two for us?
Sure. Well, Sally, as I try to succinctly describe my path, I would say that when you wrestle with your conscience and you lose, you actually win.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that wrestle of conscience came down to being reared in the South as a fundamentalist Protestant Christian and having those very absolutes that many people hold. And yet, as I grew and took my faith more seriously, it became personal for me. In an effort to hold that faith and integrity, I had to reconcile the world that I was beginning to know and understand and my chosen path as a scientist and later as a doctor, how that pathway of science squared up with my understanding of religion, which I considered to be in my own DNA and have had no desire to abandon. And so having eventually ended up going to medical school and becoming an OBGYN, I found myself still wrestling with what it meant to be a person of faith and to deal with the kind of dilemmas and complex situations that came up in the context of medicine, like seeing women with unplanned unwanted pregnancies or very much desired but lethally flawed pregnancies. And for the first 12 years of my practice, I could not provide abortions. While I never questioned the right of a woman to have them, I felt conflicted about what it meant to provide them. And so that wrestle for me meant, early in my practice, diagnosing pregnancies for women and either referring them on, if I lived in an area where there was abortion care available, or simply indicating for them that I wasn't in a position to help them, but I never blocked anyone. And that eventually became uncomfortable for me, and that came to a head when I listened to a sermon by Dr. Martin Luther King, as I do often. I've just he has been a major influence on my understanding both of my life as a citizen and as a person with dignity, but also as a person who's well versed in the faith tradition of Christianity. And he took the sermon. He talked about the Good Samaritan and basically said that what made the Good Samaritan good was his ability to reverse the question of concern. He talked about a traveler having fallen and people passing him by. And the people passing him by, when they stopped, they first asked, "What will happen to me if I stop to help this person?" But the Good Samaritan, who stopped and helped the person, asked, reversed the question of concern and inquired, "What will happen to this person if I don't stop?" And that resonated deeply with me as an OBGYN, seeing women frequently with unplanned, unwanted pregnancies. And I, whereas many of my colleagues had to become comfortable providing abortions, I grew uncomfortable not providing them when I knew what women faced. And so for me, it became this deep conviction of compassion in the spiritual sense of the deepest level of love that you can have for another person is to have compassion for their suffering and to act to relieve it. And so for me in my chosen craft as a women's health provider, that meant adding to my practice abortion care along with the family planning. And so this became, quote, my calling.
Mm. That's very powerful to hear, and it feels very, very authentic. And it's always good for you to tell that story because those kinds of stories don't get heard a lot. So thank you for telling that and sharing that with us. I want to ask a question about about abortion and sort of the conflicted Americans, what most Americans think. We know that from polling that most Americans do want to keep abortion legal. At the same time, many people believe it's wrong. And because of that, a lot of people support restrictions, pretty frankly, you know, and think, well, it's a good thing that abortion should be harder to get. They shouldn't be easier to get. And that's kind of, for most people, kind of a theoretical, emotional reaction. You're somebody who's in the trenches. You work up on the front lines and you actually see these situations. So if you were talking to a voter or a typical American who said, well, I think it should be legal, but, you know, they're too easy. I think they should be harder to get. These restrictions, they make sense to me. What would you say to them? What would you say to somebody like that?
I would say, you know, I understand their concern, and I understand that it's hard to envision the morality and the sacredness of the decision. But I would say I think your ability or your decision to judge harshly women who find themselves in the position of choosing abortion is in part defiance of the reality of why abortions occur. Abortions come from unplanned, unwanted pregnancies, and the majority of women continue those pregnancies even when they're unplanned.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, the reality is that abortion represents they're never a goal for anybody who has them.
Right, it's not a goal.
And,
it's not a desire.
And
yeah.
But it also is when they make that decision, it's for them, a deep and critical one, and when that decision is made, we need to make sure that there is access to safe and legal abortion. We know that when abortion is safe and legal, that women don't die. The,
mm-hmm.
the legality or the restrictions on abortion don't really do anything to affect the number of women who make that choice. A few weeks ago, Dr. He's a doctor here at Northwestern. Dr. John Shara. He said that, you know, he was one of the original signatories of 100 OBGYNs in 1972.
Wow.
When anticipation of abortion mm-hmm. becoming legal, challenged our colleagues to provide the capacity to provide these services for women. And he very accurately predicted that if we do that, the need will be for approximately 1 in 4 pregnancies will end in abortion. That's actually what the numbers show.
Yeah.
But he said that we did not anticipate the backlash of creating, posing abortion as immoral, divorcing it from health care, villainizing women, criminalizing doctors. And so we are now finding ourselves, or doctors being assassinated. So we're in this position now. But the point that he made that I want to echo, and he said that is whether abortions are legal or not, there's no law that you can draft that's going to prevent a woman who's determined to have an abortion from trying to make that happen. So I would say to the voter who might consider himself or herself a value voter or not, that if they can look at this and look at abortion as health care,
mm-hmm.
at it as preventive care in many ways,
mm-hmm.
that the reality is there's never going to be zero abortions.
Right.
And what we should work towards is what we would call the irreducible minimum. It's just a public health concept of given the reality that there's never going to be zero, let's make sure that abortion reaches that irreducible minimum. We get it down to as low as we can, and that is reasonable given the reality that women have unplanned pregnancies and illness and that there are lethal anomalies and all of that, which is different from saying abortion should be legal and rare.
Right.
Rare means that irrespective of the circumstances, abortions aren't available. Now, we're close to that because
right.
we're making it illegal, and 92% of women live in a county with no abortion provider.
Wow.
So right now, access is very rare.
Right.
But we should make sure that any woman who needs and chooses an abortion has access to a safe one. Any woman who wants to be a parent should have the resources she needs to do that. And I think that's the right goal. So I would try and move this person from their absolute stance to being more thoughtful about how they feel. They may very well end up in the same place, but I can respect if they end up there after being extremely thoughtful about all that goes into what makes abortion necessary.
Well, and to your point, to bring out the other part of it, when you say to get abortions down to as low as we can by providing circumstances for women, and that those circumstances might mean providing a woman who finds herself pregnant, who already has two children, who doesn't have health care, with health care, with affordable child care, with a living wage. So all of these things happen in a context of how someone lives, and sometimes a woman is making the best and most responsible decisions she can make. But if we want to encourage her to be able to have a child, then she needs the supports to raise that child in a healthy way, right?
Yeah, what you just described, Sally, is that new framework that resonates deeply with me, and that is reproductive justice. And you and I have talked about this and done some work, and you are leading and training some people in that aspect. But it is the deconstruction of the silos, you know, putting people either you support adoption or you support
right.
abortion or you support
right.
child care. It's recognizing that these are all legs on a four-pod stool and that the stool doesn't stand up sturdily unless all of them are present.
That's exactly right. Right. They're all linked to each other.
And that it's
another justice issue. For my last question, I want to go back to the religion and science issue that we were talking about earlier around fetal pain. And religion and science are often opposed to each other. And in that instance, they sort of are somebody's religious beliefs pretending they're science and science saying something else. And you are a scientist and you are a religious person. Do you have any ideas about how we can talk about these things? Because we know that, you know, it's not like women who are religious don't get abortions. 73% of women who get abortions are religious. So, again, in real life, there's not the opposition that there often is in the public debate. So how can we talk in terms of science and religion about the value of life, when life begins, the value of women? How can we talk about these issues so there's some common ground, there's some solutions, and not just all this heat and acrimony?
Absolutely. I think you're right in the on the right path to where we need to go in terms of creating forums and exchanges that lead to, as you said, light and not heat.
Mm-hmm.
In my own reconciling these two, which for me has resulted in a harmonious existence, has been to again refer to my own. Influential person and mentor through his book, Dr. Martin Luther King. He said, science gives men knowledge, which is power. Religion gives man wisdom, which is control. The two are not enemies.
Mm.
So I start with the notion that that religion and science answer different questions. Religion answers oftentimes why, and science answers how. And sometimes those how and why can blend together beautifully, you know, to
mm-hmm.
have a religious understanding of life and a scientific understanding. They may, on the surface, appear to be inconclusive, but they answer different questions in a different way. So I start with that notion that they're not enemies. And in fact, the best scientists initially came out of the religious tradition. So if there's a dichotomy, it's a false one.
Yeah.
So that's first. I break down that false distinction between science and religion. there are different ways of understanding reality as we know it. Second, a very powerful sermon that I came across in further reading and trying to reconcile for myself these two powerful entities in my life had to do with a sermon by Harry Emerson Fosdick, preached in 1922, called Shall the Fundamentalists Win?
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he basically articulates the fact that as the scientific paradigm has increased the knowledge base and our awareness and reality of our universe, moving from the Earth circle, the sun circles around the Earth, to the Earth moving around the sun, and the scientists who discovered that were working to declare the magnificence of God, but they were trying to describe the mechanism and not refute mm-hmm. why. He said that people in the same faith tradition can hold deeply that tradition, and one can believe quite literally, for example, in virgin birth and bodily resurrection, and the other may not believe in that literally in terms of having more of an empiric approach, but may still value that tradition deeply.
Mm-hmm.
He says that that we have to break down the distinction and that not one perspective rule over the other. And so if fundamentalists get their way and they insist on a very concrete, literal, biblically inerrant approach to spirituality, or in this case Christianity, they will seek to excommunicate those people who maybe don't believe in virgin birth, but see virgin birth as maybe a way of explaining the unique life path of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And those aren't mutually exclusive. So I start with the notion that there has to be room within the faith tradition for us to be equally committed, have opposite opinions, but be left intact with a reverence for the tradition that we hold in common. And I think if we could get people who, again, approach the question of life from a scientific standpoint, the people who approach that from a religious standpoint, to realize that they are not arguing different points, then that might be the beginning of a dialogue. But one of the things I do want to avoid in the pursuit of a more civil discourse is the posing of false equivalencies.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the notion that pro-life and pro-choice are equal and different opinions, both held in reverence and should be respected equally. I think that's a false equivalency. I think that people who support abortion are also pro-life. Their point of view is the life of the mother.
Right.
What is established and what we can all agree on. There's no question when a woman's sitting before you that she's female and that she's pregnant. What the law has decided is that prior to viability, the state has no compelling interest to force a woman to continue her pregnancy. So we have to recognize that to equate those two positions is a false equivalency, and it allows the media to appear mm-hmm. as unbiased, but it lends an unnecessary credence, and it further complicates rather than allowing us to deal with the facts and to allow the facts to illuminate the reality and allow, let things stand for themselves. I think if people understood that at no point does a woman lose her right to self-determination and agency, and at least from the standpoint of the law, a woman loses the right to discontinue a pregnancy voluntarily after viability, but prior to that, that's a decision between she and her doctor.
Right.
And so now, if we're talking about at 20 weeks, the state has no compelling interest, and so therefore no other individual can have a compelling interest in preventing a woman from ending a pregnancy before 24 weeks.
Right. Well, that's both knowledge and wisdom. That is both the how and the why, and it's very persuasive on some really, really difficult subjects. So we're really glad and grateful to have your insights and your knowledge as well, and the good work that you're doing. It's both the intellectual and the spiritual contributions, and then on the ground actually providing medical services, which is a very, very rare combination. So thank you very, very much for taking time to being with us and sharing these good thoughts.
My pleasure, Sally. Always a pleasure.
And thank you for your good work.
Sure.
Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.